Welcome to the Transatlanticist Politics Podcast at the American Centrum in Hamburg, Germany. As always, I'm your host, Andrew Sola. And with me today to discuss recent developments in the European Union is the Transatlanticist's resident EU expert, Dr. Günter Donner. Welcome, Günter.
Thanks for having me.
So today we will discuss the two most recent important elections in Sweden and Italy. How do we explain the victory of far-right parties in both Sweden and Italy? Is the European electorate moving towards the right, or are far-right parties moving to the middle? So let's get started with Sweden. Sweden went to the polls on the 11th of September, and there were eight parties who essentially won seats in Sweden, but we're just going to focus on three because things got really complex really fast in Sweden. So we're going to talk about the Social Democrats, who were the center-left ruling party in the previous government. And then these names sound similar. The second party is the Sweden Democrats, not the Social Democrats, the Sweden Democrats. And they've been variously described as a far-right extremist party. Of course, they don't think of themselves that way. And lastly, we have the Moderates, which is the center-right party. And they are indeed heading the new coalition government. So first, it's important to remember that Sweden has a parliamentary system that requires coalitions to form a majority. In this way, Sweden is much more like Germany than, for example, the United States. So there are eight parties, as I said, who won seats in parliament. The Social Democrat Party won the most votes, just over 30%. And these Social Democrats were ruling the center-left coalition until these elections. In fact, they increased their vote share by 2% from the last election. And you would think that that's a good result for a ruling party to increase their vote share. You would expect them to then stay in power. But that did not happen. Why? Because the far-right anti-immigration Sweden Democrats won the second most votes at about 20.5%, 20.5%. What's most interesting about this story is that the Sweden Democrats increased its vote share enormously in just 10 years. In fact, in 2010, they only received 5% of the vote and were considered a fringe extremist party. And now they're at over 20%, and they are in a position to make or break the next government. Now, despite the fact that the Sweden Democrats came in second, and they could have then led a majority right-wing coalition through joining with other center and center-right parties, they remain unpalatable or distasteful to some of the traditional parties in Sweden. And this is where things start getting complicated. So the third-placed vote, the center-right party, the Moderates, this is the traditional center-right party, got just over 19% of the vote. So they came in third. They're not extremists. But they were selected to form the new coalition government, not the Sweden Democrats, because, as I said, the Sweden Democrats are a little bit unpalatable still. So even though the Sweden Democrats captured more votes than the Moderates, they are, in fact, junior partners in the ruling coalition. On the 14th of October, the Moderates, the Sweden Democrats, and two other parties on the right agreed to form a coalition government with a one-seat majority in parliament. Let me repeat, they have a one-seat majority, which is razor thin. We'll see what this leads in terms of stability. Not sure yet. However, it gets even more complicated because on the 18th of October, which was yesterday, we are recording on the 19th of October, the Moderates announced their coalition government cabinet, and the Sweden Democrats were excluded from all ministry positions. So the Sweden Democrats are both the biggest party in the governing coalition and simultaneously powerless in a certain respect because they are not running any government ministries. So it's a tangled web. I talked a little bit about these technical issues, Gunter. But could you talk a little bit about why the far-right Sweden Democrats have surged in the polls over the last decade?
Yes. If you look back at the party history or the political history of Sweden, Sweden is a country that has been dominated by social democracies, social democrats in one way or other, for almost for more than half a century. In fact, it was the Social Democratic Party which during the 30s formed and created what we now understand as the Swedish model, in inverted commas. That means an abundant welfare state, huge privileges given to people, a strong position of the state, and a very strong political influence on the economy, be this through massive taxation, be this through channeled investments and the like. During the 50s and 60s, the Swedish Democrats ruled almost unchallenged. There was no party strong enough to topple their course. There were no Greens then. When the Green Party, Miljöpartiet in Swedish, when they came into existence, they of course drew votes from the Social Democrats, as did a few other parties. So the extreme left, which is also quite strong for a Central European country of the Swedish general wealth, quite strong. During the 50s and 60s, they were openly pro-Moscow communists. That changed. Now they become radical redistributionists and whatever, attracting opposition towards a party, namely the Social Democrats, that was almost equaled with the state. You have to bear this in mind to understand why do people want a change, or what they have to do to achieve this. And the first attempt to change it, or the first successful attempt, was in 1991. So that's a few decades ago, but not that long, when moderate party boss Carl Bildt, later a famous European civil servant and politician, formed his first non-social democratic government. That was 1991. So the moderates were they call themselves borgerligt. That means bourgeois in a positive way, so not socialist. You have to bear in mind that until the late 80s, the Swedish social democrats were rather far more left than, for instance, the Austrian or the German social democrats. They were quite anti-American, they were quite anti-NATO, and they were probably quite happy seeing themselves as the world's pattern book country others would have to follow. I will never forget when I bumped into a Swedish politician in Brussels talking that Sweden is the world's leading moral superpower, having the right to tell others what to do and what to leave. All this was based on a few not very realistic assumptions, namely that Sweden could remain neutral forever. Neutrality was part of the Swedish history, had served them well during the First and the Second World War, whereas after the end of the Second World War and the Cold War, Sweden could seriously no longer consider herself neutral. Being neutral means I don't care who wins. Sweden, of course, could have never preferred a Stalinist or Brezhnev rule over Europe. So they were indirectly benefiting from that NATO, with American help, managed to contain the Russian and Soviet attempts to further destabilize post-war Europe. But that was a part of the ideology, as was a number of other things: redistribution, anti-capitalism, pro-third world, verbal talk more than actual financial aid. And all this culminated in the early 90s when the Soviet Union fell down. Sweden came into massive economic struggle. They had to struggle for economic survival. They out of a sudden had a high unemployment rate, completely unknown to the country. And that means less tax revenue. So they had a problem. The Social Democrats had to go, and Bildt came. Bildt wasn't too successful. He managed to open the Swedish idea for Europe. Prior to that, the Social Democrats were not in favor of joining the EU. In 1995, that was a first major step. Sweden joined the EU, and that was largely prepared, had been prepared by Carl Bildt.
That was under the moderates government or under the returned Social Democrats?
That was under the second half term of Bildt, but with the consent. Sweden is a society built on consensus. With the consent of the then Social Democrats, who may have realized that this is probably a wise idea. Before, the left-wing radical part would have criticized the EU as favoring capitalism, in inverted commas. That was a sledgehammer word discussion, ruled not by analysis, but by catchy words. So that even the Social Democrats, they have changed a lot from the days of Palmer, still idolized by a certain, he was murdered. That probably made his fate so tragic. But then the moderates had a chance. To make it short, the difference in how to rule the country between the moderates and the Social Democrats is less than what you would expect in a country like Britain between a Labour or a Conservative government, or France between a socialist or a Gaullist government. The differences are rather gradual. They are mostly focused on pro-Europe, pro-integration, or we are reserved, we are so much better than the rest, we don't need this. There was no common ground for NATO membership prior to what's happened now. That was, of course, the consequence of external pressure. So the differences between these two party blocks, it's always blocks ruling Sweden. So if you read their polls there, you would see the right, the block of the right in inverted commas, and the block of the left, because the idea of the times when the Social Democrats could hope for a government just out of their own power, these days are definitely gone for good. So it's the block version, the right or bourgeois bloc, or the socialist, ecologic, communist bloc. And a few opportunist parties are hopping from one to the other. So that was the way when the last rather unproductive Prime Minister Löfven came to power. One party of the former Right Alliance hopped over to the socialist camp for whatever reason, and the government was formed in a different composition. So what made the what strengthened the extreme right? There's always been an extreme right in Sweden. That those people were stemming a century back. In former times, those were pro-German upper classes. That was the First World War. Nobility and rich citizens favored, especially the conservative nobility, they favored an alliance with the Imperial Germany against Tsarist Russia. Russia has always been the arch foe of Sweden in history. And after all, it was Russia, it was Peter the Great who ruined the Swedish domination over the whole of Northern Europe in the 18th century. So that came to nothing because for Sweden's good, that wasn't carried out. During the Second World War, there was a Nazi movement in the 30s, not very broad in terms of voter support, but among certain elites, there was an undeniable affiliation toward the pre-Second World War Hitler. Of course, this also didn't materialize. The Swedes maneuvered very, very, it's a story of its own, through the Second World War, allowing the Germans to do more than a neutral country would have been permitted to, as long as they feared that their country would be next compared to Norway. Man, the Germans were on the Swedish border, and Norway, a country easy to defend, Sweden is difficult to defend, if not impossible. So they had the Germans on their doorstep. They were trying to appease them. That was a very clever policy conducted by the then socialist prime minister, social democrats prime minister Per Albin Hansson. He kept Sweden out of the war. Sweden hugely benefited from this after the Second World War. And then the social model came into full, was brought to bear. Of course, they won over people. You win over hearts and minds if you have lots to offer. So now what changed all this? The right party was there, but it was never more than a probably aggressive, but a parliament in parliamentary terms, unimportant grouping of extremists. When the Sverigedemokrats came to public knowledge, that was a bit prior to 2005, when they first came into the parliament, then they were there as the opposition to a otherwise rather, it's very difficult to keep apart Swedish parties by their program. So they offered something for people who were waiting for different offers and messages. That was not too successful. So in the first election, they, as you said, just won 5%, which is 1% percentage point more than you need for entering the Swedish parliament. But the idea that they would disappear quickly, as did their pre-runners under different names, there were quite a lot. There was one, Keep Sweden Swedish, Bevara Sverige Svensk. That was a crypto-Nazi extreme right movement without any political weight. But the idea was, how did it work that out of this sectarian movement with ties to a rather brown history, with no party program whatsoever, no economic, no socioeconomic, no policy program, how did it come to being that this party now has 20% and more? And that was quite clear. They reformed themselves from within. So a few openly Nazi figures were kicked out, and that was Åkesson, the party boss, who is a very, I should call him clever in the British-English sense of the word. He's very clever. He's far more clever than the average bosses of extreme right-wing parties are.
By clever, you mean he's politically astute.
He is it, and he managed to change the image. And of course, there came a growing discontent with the Swedish model. The state gives you almost everything. You pay ample taxes for it. That model was lived through a cutback. So you were paying huge taxes, but what you got back was less and less. Then the second was crime. Crime in the ideal world of a welfare model as was Sweden once, there would be no reason for crime. That was their idea. And a criminal isn't an evil person you have to protect the rest of society from, but is somebody who had a whatever personal mishap during his childhood or what needs re-education and all this stuff. This may have been right in certain individual cases. This is not our topic, but definitely when imported structures came into Sweden, this model could no longer work. And during the last 10 years, crime has infested bigger cities in Sweden, and this is organized crime. It's not petty crime. It is organized crime with repercussions everybody might feel when crossing the street. It's gangs fighting each other for drugs, for shisha bars, for whatever. And if you're unlucky and come into this, into a crossfire, you'll be caught. Then came terrorism, and the biggest benefit the right could ever have was the uncontrolled immigration of foreigners from the Middle East and beyond.
And that's that this is indeed obviously a key point. The immigration point mm-hmm. is how the right wing is winning. You describe it as just now as uncontrolled immigration. Certainly, Sweden controls its own immigration policies. So, what do you mean by uncontrolled? The Swedish government knows who's getting benefits and who is there,
Legally. Let's put it straight. In 2015, Reinfeldt, a moderate, was still in power, and Reinfeldt kept the borders open. Contrary to Denmark, another of these Scandinavian super social state models, they were very strict from the onset. They were limiting influx of migrants right into the systems of social aid and security. The Danes were very strict, as were the Norwegians, but the Norwegians had less problems. They just have a border with Russia, and they have a border with Sweden. Denmark was felt very threatened, was reacted very, very timely. Sweden drew it out a bit.
Sweden, again, I want to make this point clear. Just because the words we use to describe immigration are important. Sweden's policy was to allow asylum seekers, refugees, and immigrants into its country legally.
At the beginning.
These are documented, not undocumented migrants like the U.S., where maybe 30 million people in the U.S. have no legal right to be here. Everyone in Sweden pretty much has a legal basis for being there.
Was given one and was given direct access to the welfare state. That's the big difference with America. You can't compare it. I mean, if you make it crystal clear, you go to Sweden to connect with the Swedish welfare state model. The Danish was far more generous. The Swedish model is enormously generous, opening up channels. The Danish was much more. They cut it back as early as late 15. They were offering about 1,600 euros a month. Just for a signature, I need asylum. And then you would wait years for your asylum procedures. But during this time, you could have access to those funds, to language courses, to healthcare. I mean, things you wouldn't, if you transfer this and if you were to advocate this, to make it public in parts of the US, people may come. I mean, who pays you more than 1,000 euros a month for doing nothing? And gives you free access to the welfare state. So that was far more generous than in Germany. Far more
right.
generous.
So the
they were not illegal. There is
right,
probably
right. That's the distinction that I want to make. It's not like these people somehow are sneaking their way in and living.
No, not at all.
Living sort of.
I mean, that was necessary. The idea was we consider them to be victims of violence in their home state. They did not insist on the Dublin. We had the Dublin agreement discussed once, so that you entered the EU there, and that's the first country of first contact is your country for asylum. In this case, Sweden wouldn't have had many problems or many asylum seekers, but they were in the early month, probably year. After 2015-16, they were taking up anybody who came and knocked on their door. And then the Danes cut short transfer, and you getting to Sweden without passing Denmark was impossible. That led to a development in Swedish, especially in urban centers, is they had enormous numbers of refugees. Those were then, by public arrangement, by the administrative arrangement, dispersed to the various communes or regional municipalities. That, of course, means that they preferred the asylum seekers, of course, being sent to the three big cities. The three big cities used to have large amounts of minorities, a fact you would not find in rural environments, certainly not in the north. And not even in central Sweden. So by adding or fueling more people, by channeling more people to the big cities, the problems there became rather evident. I mean, and what you have, and that's a fact, what you have in Sweden, in three big Swedish cities, be this Gothenburg, Malmö, or Stockholm, you have the tendency for ghettoization because the integration of these people failed abysmally. They keep to themselves. There are always exceptions confirming the rules. There are individuals who integrate perfectly into the Swedish society. But what you see in many parts of these cities is right the contrary. That was felt as a problem. And out of it, they came, of course, into existing structures. If you now look at certain places in Gothenburg or Stockholm, a police car on its own wouldn't probably go. The police force has traditionally been rather weak, and you cannot compare it to American standards, for whatever reason, for good or for bad. But the society was not prepared for a potential conflict arising out of this. And the theoretical approach that if you give social aid, they become perfect Swedes within a month, just didn't work. And this has
so just to, and I'm gonna jump in here just to give some one important stat. So Sweden is a country with 10 million residents, and now 20% are foreign born, so one in five. And I'm guessing 20 years ago it was presumably much less.
It was, whereas you have to call a spade a spade. Sweden has always had an immigration from other countries. Above all, in former times, it was Finland. Finland, once a Swedish colony, in inverted commas, much to their dislike, to the dislike of Finns. During the 20s and 30s, people came from very poor Finland to Sweden, then much richer than Finland. This immigration has never posed a problem. For whatever reason, I mean, some of the reasons have to be named. There was a certain immigration from the Baltic countries during the aftermath of the Second World War. This too wasn't a problem. But the integration from countries far away and from with different cultures required, evidently, a different handling if the integration were to succeed. And in many cases, this probably wasn't carried out. And due to the rather short period of time when more people came into the country, and certainly also due to the rather harsh measures Denmark and Norway imposed on immigration, many Swedes became reluctant to tolerate this. And the Swedish extreme right made use of this. I mean, their idea was probably not we can stop it, we have an idea how to. They didn't. But they realized immediately that this is a weak point in the established strategy of the ruling party, which they could exploit to the fullest. And I think this is one thing. And during the last year, or last 2 years, this crime situation, I you have to put apart terrorist things with immigrants from countries far away with a Islamic background, or Islamist background, if as you would like to call it. That was one thing. A few such occurrences indeed were there, but the other was the omnipresence of certain parts of town no longer the ones where you would like to go, and the weakness of the police force not able to cope with it. And that gave arguments, and that gave probably that made people listen to the extreme right. Yes, and the extreme right changed again. I mean, the extreme right has been rather flexible with their basic standpoints. They were fiercely against the European Union. They now have reduced from "we are fiercely against," "we are highly critical," but they're no longer for leaving Europe and all this. And they also agreed to joining NATO, which in former times the right party wouldn't have done, because Swedes would have to invest more in their own defence. So they are very flexible in terms of we concentrate on one topic and we push the others a bit away. They're hard to really tie down to certain positions.
All right, let's just do a rapid fire series of questions, because I think now we have a good sense of how the right wing became successful in elections in Sweden. But let's just look at some of the implications. So what do you think, practically speaking, can this governing right coalition do about immigration policy? What will they actually do?
Well, I think, strangely enough, this is now no longer topic number one. Topic number one, of course, now is energy. Immigration, what would even the previous government made limited immigration, made it far more difficult to apply for asylum, but probably it was a bit too late. And let's not forget that was the moderates who just kept all the doors open. It was not the Social Democrats. Well, what will they do? The first thing they've already announced is they will build new nuclear energy power plants of a very modern type, whatever. So the idea, if we have to make Swedish industry and Swedish households largely independent from alien support to have the energy they need, that's probably quite interesting.
They will stay the course on NATO membership. There will be no changes there.
No doubt about it.
And you said there's also no more discussion of Swexit, Sweden leaving the EU.
Of course not. I mean, not at all. I consider it a rather clever move of both Kristersson and the extreme right parties, very Democrats, that the latter do not form part of the government.
Yeah, so as I said in the introduction, the moderates have, in theory, joined with the Sweden Democrats, but they're not giving them any government ministries, any cabinet positions. Why would the Sweden Democrats have accepted that?
Well, that again shows that they are rather, well, it's always difficult to say so, but they're strategically well led. You win little by a government post. What you do is, their massive breakthrough was, there was a thing called November Kompromissen. That was a compromise among all the other parties never to talk or whatever to associate, to affiliate with the extreme right. When they were having 5 or 8 or 10%, that was still possible. Now where they are the second strongest party, this is unrealistic. So what the Sverigedemokrater were able to perform is, we allow a change in government. We agree they may have an agenda they have agreed upon, but it's necessary. And we will not compromise the new government with an Åkesson being interior minister. And I think this is, don't misunderstand me, but you have to analyze this in a non-emotional fashion. This is a brilliant move, strategically speaking. So they have the moderates, the Christian Democrats, and the Liberal Party, the Reformed Liberal Party. The Liberal Party in Sweden is a question of its own, forming the government, and they all bank on the Sverigedemokrater for support in parliament. So in a way, they would have, and that's probably, that will define whether they are successful or not. Do they have an agenda that's been crystal clearly defined, what they will do and the others will support, or don't they? If they have it, they can go ahead. If they don't, their alliance, in inverted commas, it's more than it's not a coalition, it's an alliance. Yeah, that will fail. I was quite surprised. We are about to talk about Italy, where the exact opposite is occurring, or France, that the extreme right in Sweden performed strategically so cleverly, or so well, if you look from their own perspective. That they are there now is a fact society has to deal with. The idea that we don't like this party for this and this, probably justified reason, won't help. We need an answer, and we need to analyze why did so many voters hop away from other parties. And there's again a huge difference to Italy, where the hop
right. Well, we're jumping ahead of ourselves because we let's jump to Italy, as it were, formally here. But you raised the important question that I want to come back to with Italy. I'm setting this up as a right or wrong question or an A or B answer, but the question is this. Are the far-right parties moving to the center, or is the electorate in Europe moving to the right?
You would have a different answer as for Sweden or for Italy.
Okay, so we'll explore that then. But that's, again, a very interesting thing, because you can see evidence to support both sides, and maybe it is country-specific. Now, Italy had elections on the 25th of September, so just a couple of weeks after the Sweden elections. And in some ways, a similar narrative to Sweden played out in Italy, but not, of course, the comparisons are limited. But Sweden has a parliamentary system, so does Italy. You've got to build a coalition in order to have a governing majority. And like in Sweden, a far-right party with fascist roots captured huge gains. In Sweden, it was the Sweden Democrats. In Italy, the party is called the Fratelli d'Italia, the Brothers of Italy, which sounds very conservative and patriarchal. The leader of the party, however, is a woman, not a man, which is interesting, and it's certainly making traditional leaders and male leaders in Italian politics angry. In fact, Silvio Berlusconi said some nasty things about his ally, Giorgia Meloni. So the leader of the Brothers of Italy is, in fact, a woman, Giorgia Meloni. We saw that in the Sweden Democrats' case, they went from 5% of the votes to slightly over 20% in 10 years. They went from 5% to 20%. What's interesting about the Fratelli d'Italia is they went from 5% in 2018 to 25% in a mere 4 years, which is a huge meteoric rise, far faster than the Swedish Democrats. So Giorgia Meloni will lead a hard-right coalition with the usual suspects on the Italian right. Old Silvio is back from the Forza Italia party. Now, it's interesting that Meloni captured votes from these other right-wing parties in order to get to 25%. She probably got about 10% from La Lega and about 5% from Forza Italia, which for me indicates that maybe the Italian right is coalescing around her. They have or have had some pretty strong policy differences, namely their stances on Russia and Russian gas, the EU, EU subsidies, and the economy in general. So Italian politics is mightily complex. What are some important points you would like to make about what happened in Italy?
Well, what happened, to be clear, is a disaster. It's a disaster for Italy and it's a disaster for Europe, to be quite clear about it. I think it's easy to understand this if you look at the traditional history of Italian government forming, government lifespan, and other. I think this is government number 69 since 1946. And if elected, Meloni will be prime minister number 31. Italian governments normally don't last long. I think a handful during this huge span have lasted longer than 3-4 years. What is interesting is the idea of a party. A party in Italy is a thing you could create from one day to the other. If you look at the previous government was centered around Draghi. Draghi is an outstanding economist, and he was the universally most respected Italian politician for decades. He had mastered the Euro plan through whatever types of crises. He was president of the European Central Bank. He's an expert in his own right. He's not a member of any party, probably for very good reason. So he was created prime minister, and he had a motley array of 8 parties. Some parties had just come into being. So hopping off from one around a figure, around a personality, creating his own party, because there is still the old clientele structure in Italian politics. A certain political leader has a clientele wherever, in regions, in bureaucrats, in soldiers, in police force, wherever. So he needs a party, a label around him. Being member of a party doesn't mean much. If you look at party programs, they are mostly null and void. And very, very little of what's been written once, if at all, has ever been carried out. A party is a momentary configuration around leading figures to be prominent in politics and to serve the model of how elections work in Italy. That is the one big difference to the rest of the world problem. So if we now look at these three leaders, and that's worthwhile because it may reveal ideas of what we have to expect.
Let's start
with Berlusconi. I mean, we know Berlusconi, and Berlusconi is a hybrid between a jester and Donald Trump.
Trumpusconi.
Whatever. He's created an empire around himself based on his own money or based on other people's money. Nobody knows. Nobody's ever cared for. He started playing the squeeze box on the cruise vessel in the 50s, and he became a multi-billionaire. He's certainly probably richer than Trump. But he's stone old, and he has had one scandal after the other. I mean, he had to appear in court many times. And of course, he was condemned once, but not really, and that was later revoked. So he's well connected, but I think he's at the end of his tether as is political attraction concerned. How could young people let's face the Italian society. The Italian society is one of the most unjust in Europe. We have elite, very well-to-do and living in abundance, and we have masses of people struggling for survival. And that was prior to the energy crisis. The Italian welfare state is existing in certain regions, functioning well, in others not at all. It's just a far cry if you fall ill in Calabria or in Sicily or in Venice. That's a huge difference, though it's the same legal basis and the same economic basis, but the factors are different. All this leads people to, or forces people to look for quick arrangements. There is no prime hope in that the state could change or will make it better for me. Most Italians have given up the hope that this rather motley arrange of political parties, permanently new parties popping into existence and disappearing like nothing, like a firecracker, that they will actually change their individual Jack and Jill lot. They won't. And this is one thing. There is less trust into we can, with the tools we have in our democracy, we can change our own lot. And this belief has almost disappeared. So then there are people who are interested for whatever reason, for a nice job, for more funding for universities, for more funding for the military, have individual certain limited goals that could probably benefit from a certain person being responsible for a certain sector. And there we are with clientelism again, something we just don't have that much in other countries. Now, Berlusconi, once he had at least two governments. Meloni was a youngster working in, I think, Berlusconi II government around 2008-10 for 2 years as a minister for sports and young people. You see, this ministry is there, has a building, people get a job there. What they do, nobody knows. And the outcome has never been checked. But she was there, but she was a nothing in this. And this ranking of prestige jobs. And now she is on top, that will for Berlusconi be unbearable. Salvini is another type, an upstart with a rather opaque background, who started once as a right fighter for the extreme north. His background was the Lega Nord. They wanted to cut off from Italy. They wanted to create a state around Milan. Then they realized this is probably contrary to the Italian history. I mean, let's not forget that the huge amount of bloodshed, fighting, and political engagement that created Italy around about the middle of the 19th century.
Just to remember, there are lots of regional prejudices in Italy still.
Of course. But the idea of Italy non-existing doesn't mean that the Bourbon state of the two Sicilies would reappear on the globe. So the idea that there has to be a national state, and that Calabrian misery can never be cured out of Calabrian resources. I think that is rather widespread. And so it never appeared in the poor, deprived regions. It appeared where there was wealth concentrated, in the north. Then the right-wingers realized it's probably far wiser to make this, to cut the north out of it, and they renamed themselves and they started afresh.
So the Northern League, just to explain to everyone, Salvini renamed the Northern League, just the League, mm-hmm. to remove its regional associations.
Indeed. Thereby abandoning all the basic principles of this movement had built up during many years. So that goes to show how quickly a party is adapted to the individual preferences of a leader at the given moment. Salvini is not a very serious person. I would be very careful. He had been deputy prime minister, minister of the interior, which brought him into many legal conflicts in a harsh and illegal treatment of asylum seekers, in conflict with the rather praiseworthy activities of the Italian Navy, saving thousands from the Mediterranean refugee chaos. But then they didn't want to have them anymore. They'd never left the Dublin Agreement. They couldn't. So they maneuvered hither and thither and just creating new expectations among their clientele. Salvini's star has been sinking for quite a while now. And don't forget, he was the strongest element of the extreme right a few years ago. And now he's lost a lot, and he's almost as weak as is the Berlusconi movement. So now to the Fratelli d'Italia. They have clear roots in the Movimento Sociale, which is the direct follower of the fascist movement Mussolini created in the early 20s. Meloni plays on this instrument. This is nostalgia. I mean, don't forget, there is a monument at Mussolini's grave. If you look at it, on the internet, you will be flabbergasted to transpond this to Austria or Germany. The idea that a brutal dictator of the fascist period is still considered as a respectful part of Italian history, even celebrated, that would be a crime. That would bring you in behind bars in Germany.
I've actually been there, not to pay homage, just out of curiosity.
Yeah, one has to look at it.
To see how deep Mussolini still is part of the national identity for some Italians.
For some people. And the idea is, why is this possible? This is possible because, contrary to Hitler, who led his country into utter devastation and finally shot himself, Mussolini was arrested by the Nazis, freed by the Nazis, instrumentalized as a puppet by the Nazis during the last year, whatever, of the most gruesome sufferings the Italian people had to go through. So Italian fascism ended when the High Council of the Fascist Party ordered Mussolini to go. This wouldn't have been possible with the Hitler state. And then he was shot by guerrillas, by partisans. And all this probably added to the fact that he wasn't as bad as people think he made. That's exactly Meloni's way of thinking. He wasn't as bad as they all say. He was not as dangerous as Hitler, which is right. He made many faults. She named them. She shouldn't have entered the war. He shouldn't have discriminated the Jews on German command. During the 30s, it started, and the like. So the idea is she has realized there is some rather undefined desire within the Italian population for a strong man. And I think if you consider Mussolini just the figure, the only strong man they could lay their hand on, there was no other. So Mussolini as a strong man, as a contrasting the chaos of Italian party politics. So that makes this, to certain parts of the voter, it makes them think about, why not have a strong man again when we were A, respected? Whether this was the case remains to be seen. Whether we had less problems with party politics than we had today. So it's not that we are, that Mussolini suppressed all the other parties and all this. He was never head of state. I mean, during his reign, that Italy was a monarchy. The king was there, but the king was weak. So he had less symbolic power, but he had a huge post-mortem symbolic power as the figure saving Italy from party politics, which is generally considered to be of inferior quality and of no use for the country, nor for the individual. So this does not, should not explain that this is right, but it explains a state of misery of the Italian parliamentary system and the Italian party world. So many people were fed up with these coalition governments, and think back, I think it was around 1998, when another European, Romano Prodi, once a commissioner of the European Union, formed a government of, I think, 13 or 14 parties, which of course lasted a year. Then it fell apart. So now back to Meloni. She is, part, what is very, very critical with her is his, her party followers. So she has now appointed the president of the Senate, the second in prestige of the Italian state, the president of the Senate. He has no great political power. A funny old man from Sicily who has
with a great collection of fascist artifacts.
Oh, yes. And he will not be the only one, rest assured. But he has nothing to tell people, really. He has no message. He has the idea that was better then, let's try it again, is ridiculous. So what they had as a party program is has been rather opaque and ambiguous. So once, many years ago, they wanted to out of the union, out of the euro, out of the European Union, out of the euro, and all this. Oh, this is nothing. Italy, the day they would announce this, the day after they have to declare state bankruptcy, Italy is totally depending on the European Union, on European support, and would be hopelessly lost without, and that is, she knows it.
So let's just go again, just because we are running out of time, we need to do a little final rapid fire on Italy. Will there be any major policy changes due to this new government, or will Italian politics trundle along in the way it's always done?
I think so, and what I expect is huge interior bickering and conflict right from the start. The alliance of these three characters won't last. The thing is, what will come thereafter? And that is an open question. Let me finish with this. My hope for a pro-European, democratic and constructive Italy, worth its name, because Italy is could be a highly productive country. It is it has innovation, it has quality products, the world sought after the world over. The thing is, Italy has to reduce bureaucracy, has to make state administration far more efficient as it is today. And as long as they consider the state is the food chamber or the food basket for political cronies, this won't change. And these three people certainly won't change it. They will have a scapegoat. I don't know who it is. Probably it's the poor asylum seekers. They are not the problem of today. Salvini has a very close thing with Putin. He took millions from the KGB, far more than Madame Le Pen. And so that will be a problem, but his political influence is nothing. What can he do? I would give this government less than a year, but maybe a year hence we will discuss this and I may be wrong. But I don't think that, because the programs are so irrelevant, that the common denominator of these people is stable enough to bear the weight of their rivalry. And it's personal gain they are looking after. It's personal prestige they look after. It's not a realization of party programs for the electorate that would control it. I don't think so. What I think is it's their personal, I'm head of state, I'm important, I'm the extreme right. And every three of them sees himself as I'm the winning factor, and that won't last. It will weaken Italy, and it will probably exacerbate the Italian economic problems, because very little productive will be done. What they now question, and this is to enter details, they question academically the supremacy of EU legislation over Italian legislation, which is absurd.
And well, Gunther, maybe another time we'll discuss the supremacy of legal codes in the European Union, which is a very fun topic, but we'll have to leave it for today. But the question that we had was, are the far-right parties moving to the center, or is the electorate in Europe moving to the right? So in Italy, I think that that's not the right question. The other way to think about these things is that we can focus on flowers growing in the field or the soil in which these flowers are growing. So the soil in Italy is one where we focus on these flowers growing in the field. We focus on the Berlusconis, the Salvinis, the Melonis. And Italian politics will always generate these flowers in their political soil, as it were. But Sweden's different. Sweden's a little bit different. Sweden doesn't have this focus on the celebrity, the powerful person. In fact, it's hard to think of any Swedish politician as being particularly charismatic, I would argue.
In former times, the way.
So the soil in Sweden is much different than the soil in Italy. And I guess I'll give you the last word here. In general, we've seen the difference between Sweden and Italy, but in general, how would you respond to that question? Are far-right parties moving to the center, or is the electorate in Europe in general moving farther to the right?
As for Sweden, it's really that far-right parties benefit from complacency of the democratic majority. In any case, voting for a radical party is a vote of protest, a vote of discontent. So now the question is, can the existing parties filter this discontent? Can they influence it? Can they win over people? Can they win back people? Or will discontented voters for good remain with the extreme right? For this, you have to have clear answers and you have to tie down the extreme right. That is your program, that is your suggestion for solutions, and that is your outcome. And if you do this, we will see what comes out of it. So it's very easy for the Swedish Democrats, who are not part of the government. That is something you could not expect from a Meloni or the other two. I think that there, of course, the electorate moved to the right because they were disappointed with what the left had offered them for the last decade or so. In Italy, it's looking for people, for protest, and for change. But the thing is, change, those looking for change will expect rapid results. And if there is no change, their preferences may shift. Look at Five Stars. Five Stars was a populist movement, and you couldn't really say whether it's right or left or vulgar or anarchist or whatever. It was everything. Five Star survived due to this clientelism because they got more votes than expected in the southern Italy.
I think the better example, Gunther, of the rapid shift is Fratelli d'Italia, that could increase five times their vote share in a mere 4 years, from 5% to 25%.
The other right-wing parties were so crippled by their leaders, and people were running away from Cinque Stelle. So Cinque Stelle voters, Berlusconi and Salvini voters made up for Meloni. It's not said that this after, if we were to see another election within three quarters of a year, it's far from certain that this will repeat itself.
Yeah, she could lose 20% just as easily. Okay, so I think that's all we have time for today. And of course, it will be interesting to see in the next round of elections in Sweden and Italy, what has happened to the grievances of the electorate about immigration and energy, and indeed then what will happen with their votes. So thank you, Gunther Donner, again for sharing your expertise. And thank you, everyone, for listening to the Transatlanticist Politics Podcast at the Americazentrum in Hamburg. Thank you.
And just so you know, once again, the views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the guests or the host, not the AmericaZentrum, which does not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Thanks again for listening.